Welcome to CounselorAudioSource.net. Counselor Audio Source is a weekly podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at CounselorAudioSource.net. This week on Counselor Audio Source, Dr. Betsy Page of Kent State University interviews Dr. Jane Bissler regarding grief counseling with individuals, couples, families, and groups.
Hi, this is Betsy Page for Counselor Audio Source, and today I have Jane Bissler with me, and she's going to talk with us a little bit about grief and grief counseling and some techniques that counselors can use.
Sounds great.
Jane, do you want to talk a little bit about what grief is?
Right. Grief is that emotional response that people have to all kinds of different losses. Doesn't necessarily mean just the death of a person or a loved one or a pet. It can also be losses due to divorce, job change, moving, all kinds of different things.
And this is pretty common for people to experience grief then, when you talk about the wide range of things that could cause people to have grief.
Most of the grief that we really see day to day in our offices is what we call an uncomplicated grief. And those techniques of working in the counseling are more the standard cognitive or narrative therapy, where you're working with cognitive distortions and trying to change those, or a narrative where you're trying to have them restory. There's also a kind of grief that we term as complicated or traumatic grief, and that's a little bit different, and we're using much more of an eclectic approach with those kinds of grief. A complicated grief is really one that is off time and or sudden. And off time is really about being out of the natural order of life, like the death of a child, the death of a spouse. We plan to have those people in the generation before us die before us, our parents, significantly older siblings, aunts, uncles. So we have an awareness of that. But when we're looking at somebody in our same generation, a spouse, a partner, a sibling that's closer to our age, that makes it a little bit more complicated. And then certainly the death of a child or somebody who's much younger, who you do not think ever that person is going to die, really complicates and traumatizes the client.
So it's less expected and harder for us to understand and deal with and process.
Right, exactly.
Could you talk a little bit about some of the therapies that you use in grief work and give some information for counselors that haven't done a lot of grief work before that might be useful to them?
Sure. I think the big thing is you want to make sure that you're comfortable with whatever technique that you feel that you have utilized successfully with other kinds of clients. And I think that the field of thanatology, which is the study of death and dying, those researchers really look at the theoretical approaches that folks come into counseling with as counselors, and how they're really able to utilize that with an uncomplicated bereavement situation. So really anything that you're comfortable with can be utilized for an uncomplicated grief. When it gets to be a traumatic grief, or a one, as we talked about, as being off time, those are the ones that you really want to use some very specific approaches. And one theoretical approach that, again, that you would want to use would be more of a cognitive approach, because you'd really want to see what those distortions are. Grief is not about the loss. It's about the meaning that the client actually assigns to that grief. And so when we're looking at a cognitive distortion, and we can use a cognitive therapy to kind of create a situation where we can look at those distortions as they really are, then the client, this counselor, is able to really help the client to kind of take a different direction in what that meaning for that grief really is. Another approach that we use fairly often is a narrative style. Because, again, it's the meaning, it's the story that that client has. For instance, I have a client whose son completed suicide. And so his whole focus and his story that he tells himself is that he should have known that this child was going to take his own life. He should have known that there was a girlfriend that was not being nice to him. He should have known all of these things. By the way, the child was 13 years old. And not that age usually isn't somebody who really talks a lot to their parent. So his story that he was telling himself that this was really all his fault. And so by using a narrative approach and having him kind of re-story that in a different way that looked at some realities of the situation that this 13-year-old boy was not sharing everything about his love life.
Wasn't telling him much.
Exactly, exactly. So that way we could kind of help him to restory that and where he could take a look at what was really happening. Interesting enough that this boy completed suicide in his own bedroom playing a song over and over and over again. And when after the funeralization process and everything, the parents went back and actually transcribed that song to find out what was going on, and then went back to this kid's friends to find out what really had happened. And they said, yes, this girl had dissed him, and in a way that really created an incredible heartache and misery for this 13-year-old boy. And the parents said, why didn't you tell us this before? And they said, we thought we would get the girl in trouble. So there's a lot of misconception out there, and these kids are all telling their own story about what happened as well. And so by this parent being able to kind of restory what he has thought of, he's also been able to go into the schools and to help this particular class kind of restory what's going on as well.
So even though it was his child, he certainly wasn't the only one affected by this loss.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And usually with the death that's a traumatic death or what we call a complicated bereavement, usually there are lots and lots and lots and lots of people who are really affected adversely by the loss of this child, because again, it's off time and kids think they're invincible, as well as being very sudden. And then we get to kind of an eclecticism, and I define that as being very well founded in lots of different therapeutic approaches. It's not just winging it or, you know, come to the first thing that goes into your mind. And an example that I would give for that would be a client that I worked with whose husband actually died while they were diving off the coast of Belize. And she had gone down first, and so she saw him actually floating on the surface, not knowing what had happened. But she, you know, soon came to realize that he had had a heart attack when he jumped in the water and actually died. So when she actually presented, she was really working through a post-traumatic stress disorder, that she was having a hard time closing her eyes, taking a shower, doing anything that had anything to do with water, feeling very helpless. And so the first thing we really had to do is do whatever approaches we needed to be able to pull that PTSD back a
little
bit.
So there were some almost like physical cues that cued all these memories and the trauma.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then she went into a terrible guilt that she was here and he was not. And so we had to kind of deal with that. And then she went into an incredible anger against this diving company that they didn't know and forced him to get into the water perhaps and those kinds of things. Back to a guilt response because, again, she was alive and he wasn't. Then they started to have some developmental milestones with their children's graduation from colleges, marriages. So then she had all of that to deal with. So following her through this probably first 18 months after his death were lots of different issues that required lots of different approaches to be able to work with her. It was kind of like a different client walked into your office every single session, and not having a clue, you could have everything mapped out exactly where you wanted to go, and it was pretty much all shot down when she walked in with someplace else that she was at that particular time. And that's not unusual at all for somebody who's dealing with a complicated bereavement issue.
When you talk about time spans, like you talked about 18 months just mm-hmm. then, mm-hmm. for the benefit of counselors listening to this, if you have sort of an uncomplicated bereavement, what kind of time span do you talk to the clients about?
Usually we're talking about, for a spousal loss or a partner loss, we're usually looking at about a year before that person can find some kind of foundation. That doesn't mean they're, you know, ready to get up and dance a jig, certainly, but most at that point in time are becoming much more future-oriented, have learned ways to assimilate this loss into their life, and have, most of them have found some ritual to do that will continue to have that person's life ingrained in theirs, even though perhaps they're ready to move on into a different direction. When we're dealing with a pet loss, it's usually much shorter time frame than that. It's usually more like a 3-month, unless that's a complicated situation. Had a client at one point in time who had a baby and went home from the hospital, and her husband had cleaned out her apartment and the bank accounts and everything. And she was left with nothing, having to work 2 jobs to keep a roof over her head and the baby's head. This baby grew up, actually, to go into the military. And when he left for the military, she got a brand new puppy, a little golden retriever. And bottle fed this puppy, even though he did not need to be bottle fed, took 6 weeks off of her job, and of course 5 years later, unfortunately, this puppy died after ingesting a chew toy, and the veterinarian office sent her to me because they couldn't figure out why she was grieving so hard. So I worked with her for about 3 or 4 weeks and learned a very solid lesson at that point in time that I hadn't really done a significant intake with her because she was just so distraught when she came into my office. So after 3 or 4 weeks, she had found some foundation and we did an intake and I found out this story. And it didn't take too long to find out that what she was actually doing is she was parenting this puppy as she didn't have a chance to parent her own son. And so the loss of the puppy actually turned out to be much, much, much more significant in her life. And it took several sessions to be able to pull that around to her so that she was aware, too, what was really going on here. So usually if we're talking about a pet, we're talking probably more like 3 months, where, you know, if somebody has a really significant attachment to that pet before, again, they found some foundation. So the uncomplicated, or what we would, you know, kind of look at as normal grief, mm-hmm. you know, would be usually maximum 18 months. And that's certainly not to say that's what it is for complicated bereavement.
So in the 18 months, they would sort of work through counseling issues and then be okay to work through the rest of the issues that came up on their own.
Right, exactly. And sometimes they'll come back for just kind of a quick session, or they'll continue perhaps in a bereavement group at that point in time. But usually the individual counseling is pretty well wrapped up by then, unless other kinds of issues are arising.
Okay. So we talked a little bit about approaches. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you talked about that sounded really fascinating to me was creative approaches that you use.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about those?
Sure. Again, these are usually, well, let me back up a little bit and saying what we have really found is that the use of rituals for those people who are grieving, whether it's a normal or a non-complicated bereavement, or even a complicated bereavement, can be incredibly important. Therese Rando, who's a leading researcher in the field of thanatology, started really in 1984 to look at the use of rituals with folks and how helpful it really has been for them. But I think at that point in time, it was looked at as more of a clergy-oriented or ritual where it would be the funeralization process. It might be like for the Jewish community, you know, a year later and having the stone and having it uncovered and those kinds of things. So it was more outside. The environment was, it was being created by an external environment. What we have found now is that the use of ritual internally has been so incredibly important. And by piggybacking that use of ritual into a very creative and active response, I have found with my clients that has been extremely interesting. So, for example, one of the props that I use in counseling is a book called Tear Soup. And this is a story of Grandy who creates this soup out of memories and love and some bitter things and those kinds of things. And she even chooses the size of pot that she uses, from something that is very normal up to more than she can bear. And all the pots are actually labeled as well. And so a lot of times I'll use that book and or video with a client and have them decide what they're going to utilize as far as a ritual with utilizing recipes. One client, actually, after I showed her that movie, the next time I saw her, she brought in soup to share. And this was a spousal loss that she was dealing with. And she had put in all of his favorite flavors and all of his favorite vegetables. And so this soup gave her an opportunity to tell me really about him. And so I tried to connect it back to all the emotions that what really went into that soup. The other thing that happens with clients so often is that they become, there's no social. They become not antisocial, but their social circle becomes not as welcoming. I think for a couple of different reasons. One is that their social circle now is vulnerable to experience the same thing that they have in themselves experienced. But I think, too, is that it's a kind of a way that rewrites the address book, is that you don't have as much in common with these couples and people that you have been hanging around with. But this woman who brought the soup to me decided that she was going to take the same soup to her family members and to her friends and also to his coworkers. And what that did for her is it gave her a chance to talk about him, to hear stories about him, and for everybody to kind of join in with this same souping. Mm-hmm. The other thing that she did was she took this to a church circle. And what came out of that is kind of a personalized bereavement group. So now they have soup Saturday nights, and anybody who wants to create a soup in memory of someone brings the soup, and they all share it at somebody's house on Saturday nights. So it has really provided a lot for her. It's provided a chance to tell stories about her spouse, a chance for other people to tell her stories that perhaps she didn't know about, as well as really kind of re-socializing her into a new group of friends who have things that she now has in common. And it takes a lot of the dependency away from her work with the counselor as well as the grief group, and it allows her to create some of that socialization and some of that help outside of that therapeutic office, which is really important.
So a lot of the processing happens out in the world, right, with the folks that she used to be with or new acquaintances.
Right, exactly. Another client that I used this tear soup with decided that she was going to create memory cards, and those were her recipe cards. And so she would bring one every week when I saw her. This was also a spousal loss, but a very sudden, very young man. And so all of the different things that they had done, she created a memory about. And one day she actually came into my office, and she had a recipe card that had been tattered and torn. It was just all wrinkled up, and she kind of smoothed it out, and she cried while she told me that this was the memory of when they had to place their daughter into a drug and alcohol rehabilitation clinic, and how tough that really was for them. But by going through somebody with addiction, it really changed their whole marriage, and in hindsight really deepened it. One time she brought in a card that was had lots of intimate memories mm-hmm. on it, and so I kind of talked to her about that and what that was like for her, and she said, "Oh, Jane, that provides the soup some spice." And she said, "All relationships should have some spice." And she said, "I could never leave that out." And subsequently, what she has really done with that is she's expanded this recipe box like three times, and now keeps it on her coffee table in her living room. And she keeps a stack of blank recipe cards there. And when people come to visit her, she offers them to go through her recipe file as well as create their own recipe for what they would like to add to the Barney soup, which she calls it. So it's been really interesting to kind of watch that happen. And again, I don't prescribe what they're going to do, and it's been very interesting just to kind of give them that lead off with the book and the video and then see how they really want to create their ritual around this loss and creating their soup. One of the other things that we do is work with clients with stitches. I had worked with a couple or a woman, actually, and three children, that the her husband, and the father of the children had died of sudden cardiac death after walking the dog one evening. And these kids, I think, were 3, 5, and 8. And what happened is they just were having a terrible time, and the mom really didn't have any support in this area. They had just moved to this area, and she was really stuck here for a while. I have a friend who's a quilter, and so I had asked the mom if she would mind if we created some quilts with utilizing the father's clothing. And she said no, she thought that would be a great idea. So this quilter friend decided or agreed to make 4 different quilts. And what I asked her to do is take a pocket from Dad's dress shirt and put it in the upper right quadrant of this quilt on all 4 quilts. So the children and she each individually picked out clothing that they wanted to use for their own quilts, and we put those in 4 different bags, sent it to the quilter. When the quilts came back then, the oldest boy, who was 8 years old, as I recall, noticed that there was a pocket on the upper right-hand quadrant of all these quilts, and he said, why is that there? He said, it's like that's the pocket in Daddy's chest. And I said, that's right. And so we talked about how that they might want to use that, and what they decided to do is that every night, after they said their prayers, they were going to write a little note to Daddy and put it in his shirt pocket. And what was interesting is that they really felt like they got an answer to their question if they had asked that question and given it to Daddy during the night. And even the 3-year-old would, you know, scribble out her day's events or draw a picture or whatever and put it in the pocket. And it was interesting because the mom said that through that ritual that these kids actually designed, she felt like she was still co-parenting these children with him, which was incredibly
valid.
That's
very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Very validating for her and really helped her move on kind of into that next level. When they first came in, she wouldn't allow the children to talk about him. Because her bereavement was just, her grief was just so incredible that she just really wasn't able to contain her emotions, as she said, to be able to respond to the children in a way that wasn't incredibly scary for them. So through this, she was able to do that and to have the children kind of take the lead on what they needed to do. One of the other things that we do is I have another young man actually who died, and we decided to utilize some of his shirts and sweatshirts and make pillows out of. And so they brought them in, and we sewed the bottom, sewed across the bottom and sewed across the sleeves and left the neck open, and used stuffing then to, you know, stuff these pillows about halfway up, and took a break, and then had the clients sit down and write a letter to this young man Then they folded up the letter after some of them chose to read it, some of them chose not to, put it in the middle of this pillow, and stuffed the rest of the pillow and the arms and everything. And then we sewed the top neck closed. And then at that point in time, they all hit the floor with their pillows, deciding what they were going to do. And the adolescent sister kind of pushed it against the wall and pulled the arms of the sweatshirt around her to get a hug from her brother. The younger brother was just punching it because he said that one of the things that they loved to do was to punch each other in the arm until somebody said ouch, and that was the loser. So he was kind of simulating that. The mom just hugged it and cried and was just very poignant for her. And the father just really sobbed and just kept asking the pillow over and over why he had to drive so fast. So it kind of provided for them a way to talk to or simulate this relationship with the brother. However, it didn't have his face. So what they weren't able to do with the photograph, they were able to do with his clothing. And that has been a really interesting process for them. They now have pillow nights where everybody brings their pillow and talks about what they're currently doing. Because grief changes. You know, it morphs into all different kinds of things. And so when people create a ritual, what we're able to see when we're actually working with these folks is that ritual changes over time, because as the recipe cards, she was creating a recipe every week and bringing it in. Now that's kind of stable, and the people who are coming to visit her are now adding to that recipe box, but she doesn't feel like she has the need to do that. And the same thing with these pillows, that as that grief is kind of morphing and changing, sometimes the pillows are soggy, sometimes they're kind of tattered because they're just kind of being pulverized and used, but that grief is changing and that pillow is changing with the grief.
So when you're using these creative processes with what you're calling rituals, I'm thinking about the sort of abstractness of the concept of grief, but you've used some concrete objects to kind of help people process.
Absolutely. They have a very difficult time. You know, it's so, that loss can be so ethereal. Where is that person? Mm-hmm. Are they in heaven? It goes to their belief structure. Sometimes it's a confirmation of their belief structure, and sometimes it creates new beliefs. So when you give them something tangible that's also symbolic, they can do a lot of their grief work through that. So absolutely, it's, you know, a lot of people use symbolic rituals. A lot of the funeralization process is symbolic, although we're starting to kind of move that more into a more of a tangible, where we're bringing people's motorcycles in, and we're playing the music that they loved, and we're just, you know, bringing all kinds of fishing equipment and stitchery. And my husband was telling me the other day that somebody belonged to a card club for years and years, and so the kids came in and set up a card table with bridge hands in all three, but where mom always sat had the best bridge hand. So, you know, it is becoming a little bit more tangible as our society is more willing and more open to that.
Can you talk a little bit about kids in funerals? I know when I was a school counselor, I was often getting calls, you know, should I let my child go to the funeral or should I take them? Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. One of the things that we do, if we have the opportunity to talk with a family before the funeralization process, the calling hours. A lot of times kids are very afraid to go. We had a family whose mom was actually killed in an automobile accident, and there were three little girls. And what we did is had them come in, and I sat down with them and said, because they wanted to go, and the father wanted to take them. So, you know, that's all. We always check out, first of all, what does the family want? So the one little girl talked about how afraid she was to see her mommy in the casket, and what would she look like, and what would she smell like. And, you know, kids are sense-oriented, so you want to just build on those senses. So what I ask her to do, and lots of kids I do the same thing with, is to, I ask her to feel the back of my hand, and I said, what do you feel? And she said, well, it's warm. And I said, and what else do you feel? And she said, well, it's soft. And I said, right. And I said, I'm going to close my eyes now, and I'm going to ask you to hold up three fingers. And she, you know, or hold up a number of fingers. And so she said, okay. And I said, I can't tell how many fingers you're holding up because I can't see you. And I said, because my eyes are closed. And I said, Mommy's eyes will be closed. And I said, you know, and I checked out. They had a Christian belief structure, actually, this family did. And I said, you know, the part that makes me warm and the part that makes my skin soft and the part that allows me to see is what we call the soul. And when the soul's gone, the body's cold and it's hard and it doesn't see and it doesn't hear and it doesn't smell and it doesn't taste anything. So when you touch your mommy, because most little kids do, that's how she will feel. And that's because her soul doesn't live inside of her body anymore. Her soul lives in heaven. And so, you know, I walked in with these little kids, and they went right up and touched Mommy's hands and said, oh, they're cold and they're hard. And, you know, and the dad's like, what is going on?
And that wasn't terrifying to them because you had prepared them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's very important to make sure that we're always right with wherever that surviving parent is with kids, to make sure that we're not going to say anything to these children that the parents don't want us to hook into their belief structure. Again, it's all about the meaning that's been assigned to this by that parent. And we want to make sure that we're not going to do anything to usurp that meaning from that family. And so we have to work, it's just like any kind of counseling, you have to work where the client is. And when you're working with children, you have to work with where that parent is, mm-hmm. or where that family is. Now, sometimes after time, we can kind of work that meaning around a little bit.
So you worked with the meaning, but I would say you also worked with the concreteness that kids have.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And especially, you know, if we're working with that family long term, then again, we're going back to what's tangible for them. Is it a piece of mom's clothing? Is it a piece of jewelry? I had a little boy whose mom was killed also in a traffic accident. He loved her slips. And so what we did is we just cut a piece of slip out for him and zigzagged around the edges of it so it wouldn't ravel. And he kept it in his pocket. And in school, he would reach his hand into his pocket and feel that slip. And of course, we had made 25 of them because kids lose things. And so that was his way of reconnecting with his mom. And the continuing bonds, really, that's the most important trigger that we have found. That's the most helpful thing. And that actually came out of my dissertation, was that continuing bond, that way to stay connected with that deceased person, is the most important thing for long-term health of that client and an assimilation of the loss, as well as that client becoming future-oriented. One of the other ways that we utilize, you know, creative therapies is through songs. A lot of times people will bring in music that they have listened to that is telling a story. A client that we have, that I have, whose son was a 15-year-old boy, was killed on an ATV, has really no support at home at all for this loss. Everybody else is just like picking up the rug and sweeping it underneath. And she wants to talk about him, and she wants to talk about how she's feeling, and she wants to really work with this, and there's really absolutely no support for her to do this. So one of the things that she's done is to look toward music. There's a song by a country band called Diamond Rio that's called I Believe. And it talks about the fact that that this songwriter says, you know, I can feel your touch upon my skin. And this mom believes that sometimes when she's sitting outside and the breeze goes across just right, it is the touch of her son against her cheek, or her cheek. And it goes on and talks about, you know, there are angels watching over me, and all those kinds of things. And she has really held up this song to say, I'm not crazy. Because that's one of the beliefs that so many of our bereaved people have, is that they're losing their minds because they're not thinking correctly. They just are really having a tough time kind of holding it together and being able to do their normal everyday functions. And so this woman says, you know, if this band can perform this song in front of millions of people at all of their places, and they're singing about this, then who's to say that I'm wrong for my beliefs? And so it's really normalized a lot of that for her, and it's given her kind of a social group to be a part of, that she feels that she can get support. And so when things get kind of hairy at home, she has a whole CD of probably 25 different songs that all really speak to how she feels as she's going through this bereavement process. And she'll play those, and it gives her the ability to say, there are other people who feel the same way that I do. There are other people who are also grieving a loss. I'm not alone in this. And so it's provided a wonderful opportunity for her to be able to normalize her grief.
You speak about a particular person, but I know that you do some group work around grief and loss. And when you're organizing those groups, do you use particular songs as a stimulus to help start group discussion? Or do you work these same things into your group work?
Absolutely. Definitely work it into group work, but differently. Because I don't want to provide for them a song. I will lay out the opportunity and then have them bring the songs in, something that's been very beneficial for them. Mm-hmm, exactly. Do the same thing with recipes. A lot of times during holiday time is so tough for folks to deal with when they've had a loss. And so we'll use the recipe cards for during their Thanksgiving time. Sometimes it's food, all the favorite food of that person that they've lost. Sometimes it's memories of what goes on. I have one client actually that was in a group who utilized the recipe card at the place that her deceased husband always sat as an invitation for people to sit there and to see what he saw during the Thanksgiving meal and kind of experience what was going on from his perspective. And then she had, you know, again, recipe cards at everybody else's place to write down a memory about him. So music, songs, people have created pillows, scrapbooks. A lot of that work gets done in a group situation as well. And it depends on the makeup of the group. At Counseling for Wellness, we make very sure that our groups are homogeneous. We want to make sure that everybody's got the same kind of loss, that we're not mixing parents that have lost a child with somebody who's lost a partner, because it's a different kind of loss. And a lot of times people will say, well, my loss is worse than your loss, so therefore I can't relate. So we just take all of that out of there. And the parent group that we do run, though, does have losses through illness as well as through accident. And it's interesting because the parents who have lost the child through accident always look to the parents who have lost a child through illness as the ones who are the most bereaved, because they had to watch their child die. And the parents who have lost a child through illness look at the ones who have lost their child through accident as the one most bereaved, because they didn't have a chance to say goodbye.
Yeah.
So for parents, there's not a lot of this, well, you know, mine's worse than yours. But for spousal groups, for some reason, it just seems
to... You have to be careful of that.
Absolutely.
Group composition.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So it's been interesting to do groups as well.
Now, one of the things that you said that you might talk a bit about was healing connections.
Right. That's really about continuing bonds. And again, what really came out of my dissertation was the very top factor was that people needed to continue having that connection. And so right now what I'm working on is a book about exactly that factor that came out of that. There's some great research that's coming out in the last really 2 years about how people realize that there's absolutely no way that they can decline that this person existed. One of the counselors at Counseling for Wellness has a couple that they're working with right now that lost an adolescent son and when he was in college. And the father now says he has 2 children. And the mother says, no, we have 3 children. And that has created an incredible problem within the confines of this marriage. Because the father is in the mother's representation, disowning this mm-hmm. deceased son. Mm-hmm. And so she is so connected with the fact that we have 3 children and the memories of this child and how this child impacted the lives of the 2 surviving children and the family. And the father says, no, I don't want to explain this to anybody. It's that plus the fact that he won't talk about him at all at home, won't recognize his birth date, won't recognize his death date, is really drilling huge, huge holes in this marriage. So whether there's any kind of compromise on that, I don't know. But what we found and what researchers have found, Margaret Strobe from Norway is an incredible researcher in this field. And she's finding the same thing that anecdotally I found in my practice, which is the fact, and through my dissertation, which is the fact that people don't want to forget that this person existed, no matter what has gone on with their lives, no matter if they have gone on to have subsequent children, subsequent relationships, whatever, that child, that spouse, that partner, those people have had an incredible impact. And so there was a lot, when this research first began, there was a lot about whether or not it was real. You know, whether these pennies from heaven were really sent by the deceased person. Why, if the rainbow that came on the death date every year was really sent by that deceased person. And really what we have found out is it doesn't make any difference if it's real or not. And it doesn't make any difference if the grieving person feels like it's real or not. The fact is, these connections exist. They feel like somebody is telling them, stop at that stoplight, don't go when the light is green. They feel like there's emotional support out there for them. They feel like they can hear the words of this deceased person about, oh my gosh, I don't know what to pay, the electric bill or the gas bill. We'll pay mm-hmm. the gas bill.
Pay the
electric
gas
bill. Exactly, exactly. So it doesn't make any difference whether that can be proven or not. The fact of it is that these people believe and feel that they have this continuing connection and that they're connected at a heart level, and that the skin and flesh that we have, when that is gone, doesn't make a difference. Because again, the part that sees and the part that hears and the part that smells and tastes and feels still exists for them.
Very wonderful.
Yeah, it's been fun. It's been a great job. It's been just a great profession to do.
Well, I appreciate the wonderful techniques and your insights that you've shared. And I'm wondering, for people who are listening, would you care to recommend any resources for counselors, books or tapes or internet websites or anything that you think might be helpful?
Sure. I think pretty much anything you read by Therese Rando, and that's Rando, is a great support. Bill Warden, and I think his the book Grief Counseling and Grief Counseling or Grief Therapy, I think it was published in 1991, is a wonderful resource for counselors as well. Death Studies is a journal that has all the most recent research published in that. Omega is another journal that it would be a wonderful resource. There are lots of books. Probably my favorite for the death of a son is called Lament for a Son. And it's Wolterstein is the author of that. Probably the best book for parents who have lost a child is When the Bow Breaks. Spousal loss, if it's the death of a male, there's a wonderful book called Widowed by Lynn Kane, and that's C-A-I-N-E. If it's a death of a female, there are not any really good resources for
there's
that.
There's no one that stands out at the same level.
Right, exactly. But I think that Tear Soup, again, it would be a wonderful resource for people to be able to utilize. There are some great board games, especially working with children. The Mourning, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, after, is a board game. There's another one that's called Speak Out that allows especially adolescents to kind of talk about their feelings. ADEC is the Association of Deaf Education and Counseling, is really the premier deaf and counseling website and organization. Actually, their international conference is the last week of March in Tampa, Florida this year. And it's where a lot of the thanatologists who do primarily research present their findings.
Do you know where it is next year?
I don't know where it is next year. I don't usually run my life that way, that I look that far ahead. So I'm actually presenting on the book that I'm writing in Tampa this year. So
it'll be very interesting to see that book.
Yeah, it'll be fun. It'll be fun. Hopefully it'll be in the publisher's hands in October. So that's kind of where we're working toward.
Well, I really appreciate you talking with us today.
Thank you.
I wish you well and appreciate all the care that you give people.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Thanks.
You've just heard an interview of Dr. Jane Bissler about grief counseling, done by contributing editor Dr. Betsy Page of Kent State University. Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback on the podcast website at counselaraudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments or questions for our interview guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source, or by calling 330-871-4015. Counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any use of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is Memorial Day from Jamie Beauchamp. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering a flexible copyright for creative work.